You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Today's program is not designed to be a rehash of the 2020 presidential election, although there will be some elements of that. But what that election showed is that one of the ways that the nation is divided is in its politics. Democrat Joe Biden won 91 of the country's 100 most populated counties, while Donald Trump took 95 of the 100 smallest counties. Biden won urban areas where economic activity is growing, even taking the pandemic into account, while Trump came out on top in counties that are losing population and jobs are not as plentiful. At the same time, the last census shows America is becoming more diverse. What issues are driving this divide? Are there issues driving it at all? Joining us for this discussion today, Dr. Stephen Medvick, director of the Franklin and Marshall College's Center for Politics and Public Affairs, and the Honorable Mr. and Mrs. John C. Kunkel, Professor of Government, and Dr. Lance Bailey, Associate Professor of Political Science at Shippensburg University. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. Dr. Medvick, I'm going to ask both of you this question. I'll start with Dr. Medvick. How did the rural and urban areas of this country become so divided politically? I know that's the big question.
Yeah, it's a really great question. It's an important topic. I think you have to go back and trace this back to the late 19th century and industrialization. People started to move to cities for jobs and parties, and this happened in a number of countries around the same time, parties of labor, parties that decided they would represent workers, began to become strong in the cities. And as they became strong and as they were representing urban areas, they took into account not just the newly arrived workers who moved into cities, but people who had been there for quite a while. And this included often racial and ethnic minorities. As that began to happen, so now we're talking about the sort of mid 20th century, you begin to get rural voters who may still have been associated with that party. In this case, it's the Democrats. Begin to leave the party because of that representation of ethnic and racial minorities. But you also get some people leaving the cities because they don't like that representation. So it's a combination of workers moving to cities, a particular political party representing those interests, but then broadening those interests that they represent to minority groups, and then a kind of move away from that party in some segments of the population. And so what you end up with then is much more conservative rural areas and much more liberal urban areas.
That history is very important, but the last election, it was even more pronounced than in previous elections. Do you have a theory on why?
Yeah, so that, you know, I do think it's important to think of this as a gradual process. I mean, if you look at, say, at 1910, there's virtually no correlation between density of a population and how it votes. By 1960, as I say, sort of middle of the 20th century, you begin to see a correlation. It's not super strong, but it's a noticeable correlation. Get to the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and it becomes really, really strong, and it's only becoming stronger. So it's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think what we saw in 2016 and 2020 is sort of the latest stages of this kind of sorting that I described earlier.
You know, what's kind of ironic about that is if you go back to the 19th century, you know, you often hear the Republican Party, even today, still referred to as the Party of Lincoln, that the Republican Party was born out of and throughout the 19th century was seen as the party that, you know, that African Americans were freed from being enslaved. And mm-hmm. that even I remember talking with a senator from Texas who had changed, Phil Graham, had changed his party affiliation in the 80s. And his grandmother said, "So you're going over to that party that took over our ranch?" You know, that the even so industrialization had a whole lot to do with it. But Jackie Robinson, famous baseball player, became a civil rights pioneer, was a Republican, supported Richard Nixon. So, you know, these things didn't change overnight, did they?
No, they didn't. And a big part of the story is the New Deal and the New Deal coalition. So that coalition, you know, I think a lot of people look back to the sort of 40s and 50s and think, oh, there was so much bipartisanship and there was, you know, and there wasn't the kind of polarization we see today. But that was an aberration. I mean, what you had in the 40s and 50s was one party dominant throughout, not in every part of the country, but certainly nationwide. And the Democratic Party was dominant because they built this coalition of northern urban dwellers, factory workers, but also southern conservative, more rural voters. It was only a matter of time, though, until that coalition started to fragment. We think it started fragmenting in the 60s, but in fact, it started to fragment in the 40s. In 1948, in the Democratic National Convention, the party put forward a plank of its platform in favor of civil rights. And you had two full state delegations get up and leave from the South. They said, we're not going to stay in this party if it's going to embrace civil rights. So already by 1948, you start to see the kinds of fractures that we were talking about. You start to see the shifting of former Democrats now maybe moving out of the party and eventually ending up in the Republican Party.
So Dr. Bailey, I'll ask you the same question and see what you could add to what Dr. Mitvick had to say. How did rural and urban areas become so divided politically, especially last year?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with most of what Dr. Mitvick said in terms of the long history of this and industrialization, the shifts in partings, and what has been really a long sorting out that has been a very long process, but has finally sort of reached its, I don't know if it's pinnacle, but pretty close to its pinnacle. But this idea of sort of the country versus city folk has been around for a very long time, of course, really to the founding. And Shays' Rebellion, of course, is a rebellion of farmers against bankers, the city against the farms. And we can go through it. We see it in our literature, that this idea of the corrupting city and the virtuous rural areas, or even the other way around, right? The idea that the unknown area is full of magical, you know, Hawthorne talks about this magical woods and things like this. And so we've had this sort of back and forth between industrial money, elite interest, and rural interest as well that have gone on. And I would agree along this line is that what we get really is we move from, you know, we talk about this coalition of the New Deal coalition, we move from sort of what we might call muddied parties. So parties that have a lot of overlap and the differences aren't particularly pronounced. And there's problems with that, but the upside to it is we can all have Thanksgiving dinner together, right? And we get to a point where now we sort of, and we see people talk about it in terms of psychology and geography and race, and also the digital age. Now we're at a point where your party becomes part of your team identity, right? And we see lots of writers talking about this. And so it's no longer just one sort of side note to you. It's actually part of your actual identity. And so you can't be at church with people that don't think the way you think. And you can't have the birthday parties with the people that don't think the way you think. You try, maybe, but it becomes very, very difficult in which to do it. And part of this is this polarization in this direction, is that we see this sort of sorting out in terms of rural and urban. And we see it even within the party. Right. So Republicans in rural areas are much more pro-Trump than Republicans in urban areas. Mm-hmm. They still are Trumpy, but they're kind of cool about it. Right. It's sort of a little softer about it. And so we it sort of cuts across almost all aspects of it.
Sort of Trumpy. I kind of like
that. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah,
I know what you're saying.
Republican. But if you look at attitudes towards Trump in terms of sort of a temperature index, in rural areas, we see a lot of enthusiasm for Trump. And in urban areas, you still have a pretty strong, you know, in terms of voting record, but in terms of enthusiasm around it, it's more tempered amongst urban Republicans and even suburban Republicans.
You know,
yeah,
maybe,
if I can just quickly, that's a really important point. And what it suggests is that some of this is not, it's not entirely just self-sorting, right? So we often think of this as, well, if you're comfortable with diversity and you want a dynamic kind of setting like a city, you just move from the rural area into the city. And if you're not comfortable with that, you move out of the city into the rural area. And so there's just a self-selection sort of thing going on here. But it's not only that. It's also that there are people who don't really think much about this sort of thing. And when they find themselves in social settings with a bunch of people who think one way, their attitudes begin to shift. And so even though they're you know, there are definitely urban Republicans, but part of the reason their attitudes aren't the same as rural Republicans is because there's a kind of a social influence going on. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of both. It's a self-selection into places, you're moving to places where you want to be around like-minded people, but also there's an effect, a social kind of network effect. The context matters, and it's changing people's attitudes as well.
Mm. You know, maybe I should have titled this show, Who Can You Sit Down With at Thanksgiving and Get Along? Because Thanksgiving seems to come up very often during this discussion. But Dr. Bailey, teaching at a university that is located in a rural area, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, Shippensburg is Franklin County, Cumberland County, both went for Trump in the last election. What are the issues that rural and urban voters disagree on?
Well, there is sort of, you know, writers and researchers sort of break it into two categories, sort of this cultural aspects and these more sort of economic, or we can call maybe policy aspects along the way. And we see a lot of the cultural signaling. You can see this tremendously. And I think Virginia is not unlike Pennsylvania. In the Virginia race, you see a lot of sort of cultural signaling, mostly around race. Race is a big driver in this particular divide. But overall, a sort of a sense of populism in not a sense, a strong sort of populist sensibility in the rural area, where in the urban areas, you see much more issues around policy than cultural. Less about culture, more about policy, I would argue. So things like minimum wage and pre-K and childcare and family leave and rent control or these kinds of things that might go into. Where in the rural area, it's more about, you know, critical race theory or about parents' rights or we don't see about gay marriage as much anymore, but the role of the church and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Dr. Medvick, let me, you know, along those same lines, because, yeah, I was going to add standing for the national anthem is one of those cultural issues, that does seem to be one of the big divides between rural and urban, Republican, Democrat. President Trump, one of the ways that candidate Trump became so popular, and President Trump became so popular with his supporters, is that he talked more about cultural issues than about policy issues. And so it makes me wonder, is this an issue-oriented issue at all, or is it cultural versus policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think that it's a little bit of both. I think cultural issues are still issues. And I think there are policies behind a lot of these cultural hot button issues. Now, maybe not something like standing for the American flag, but certainly immigration, even gay marriage, right? There are policies that are put in place to govern these things. So I think those are still policy issues, but they're highly symbolic. And that's what differentiates them from the more economic issues, which are just real, you know, nuts and bolts kinds of things. And so I think it's true that in rural areas, a lot of the ideological kind of approach to politics is a more symbolic one. Whereas there's ideology in the urban areas as well, but it's centered in a kind of, again, more nuts and bolts kind of economic policy. So policies, I think, are driving this kind of all the way around. But it's also important to point out that, especially on economic issues, the American public really isn't as polarized as you might think. I mean, they're more polarized than they used to be. But there is quite a bit of agreement on things like raising the minimum wage and protecting Social Security and Medicare. So there are, if you just look at attitudes, there may not be much difference, except on the social issues. And there are some big differences. So, you know, so issues matter and policy matters, but it works in kind of different ways in rural areas and urban areas.
You're listening to one.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish what you're going to say, Doctor.
Oh, I was just going to say that's one of the special qualities of the immigration as policy issue, which is fascinating because candidate Trump in 2016, if you tracked his website, his candidate website, there was only one issue. When you went to the issues, you go to any other candidate, they talk about almost every issue. You go to Trump, it was only immigration to really late in his campaign. He already got the nomination, in fact. And immigration is special because it's both economic, and policy driven, but it has huge signaling. It has this, you know, huge signaling around issues around race and about the sort of politics of resentment, which is a big sort of a cultural catchphrase that we see in rural areas. It feeds the populism aspect of it in terms of I'm getting overlooked, I'm getting screwed, to put it bluntly, and we have this thing we can blame it on. And so immigration was just in some ways the perfect issue to capture cultural, economic, you talk about China, all these things kind of come together in one in that particular issue.
Dr. Medvick, well, I can put this question to both of you, but I'll start with Dr. Medvick. You know, immediately after Donald Trump's win in 2016, when there were many people trying to analyze what led to that victory, we heard that many rural voters or white middle-class voters felt left behind economically. But yet, in the 4 years of the Trump administration, not a whole lot changed to help those people who were the biggest supporters of Donald Trump. So I wonder whether the economic condition was a false read.
I think it was exaggerated. I don't think it was a false read necessarily, though. I mean, if you go back to 2016, you look at the roughly 500 counties, a little less than 500 counties that Hillary Clinton won, and compare them to the 2,500 roughly counties that Trump won. Two-thirds of American GDP comes out of those 500 counties that Clinton won. Two-thirds of income taxes are paid out of those counties. So there's a lot of productivity and a lot of dynamism in those places that were voting for Clinton, and less so in these rural areas. And so there has to be some part of the resentment that Dr. Bailey mentioned, which I think is a good word for it, and there's some really good studies of this, has to come from looking around, you know, oneself in a rural area or in a very small town and saying, what are the economic opportunities here? Now, it was also very easy then to connect that lack of opportunity and those resentments to things like immigration, to things like, you know, overeducated elites in the cities, right? So it became easy to sort of move people on those symbolic appeals. But I think there was real racial resentment and other kinds of resentment in a lot of those areas. But I don't think we can overlook the fact that there are really tough times in a lot of these areas. So the economics matters as well.
Dr. Bailey,
just the lack of attention, it seems like, to the issue. So part of populism again, and I think part of the rural experience in America, we could probably go back pretty far, is that you're getting overlooked, right? Mm-hmm. And that the urban centers are where the decision makers are, where the elites are, and their needs are being met and ours are not. And in some ways that's exaggerated, in some ways it's not. I mean, look at broadband infrastructure, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine for probably many of our listeners on this show of living in entire communities in which broadband and internet is essentially not available in any stable way, because it affects everything. Telemed, your schools, running small businesses, banks, data, all this kind of stuff. It creates these sort of islands. So there are real concerns that, you know, frankly, have been overlooked at different times. But
and to be clear, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but I don't think it was Mexican immigrants makes them overlooked, right? They're being overlooked, but I think the reason for why they're being overlooked is different.
Yeah, and to be clear, you know, I said there's this resentment against maybe overeducated elites in the cities, and that may make you think, oh, so there's resentment at the Democrats. There was a lot of resentment at the Republicans as well. So this sense that they were feeling overlooked, you know, a lot of rural voters looked around and said, I'm represented by Republicans in the state house or in Congress, but what are they doing for me? And that, of course, fueled the Tea Party revolt back in 2010, and also laid the groundwork for then an anti-establishment candidate like Trump to win the nomination in that party.
So hence why Drain the Swamp became so popular with so many Trump voters.
Exactly. It's a sort of a pox on both your houses. And part of that is, you know, it is tapping into real resentment there and to real attitudes. But it's also just a standard populist playbook, right? Every populist candidate in the world runs on the same exact kind of platform, because it is us versus the people, the real true people, against those evil elites who are doing their best to keep us down. Mm.
Okay. And what gets fed with that too, it's kind of fascinating because many of the problems, and I'll go back to, you know, the internet infrastructure, there's other ones that are there, transportation and other kinds of infrastructure, are really only solvable by government. There's not a market for, you know, cable companies to run cable into Pawpaw, West Virginia, right? It just doesn't exist. And so in some ways, the government is sort of the solution to some of those places in which there's not a market to drive it along the way. But again, if the problem has been that you've been kept down on elites, elites include government elites. And this drives all of it. And this is a big, another part about Trump is his authoritarianism aspect to it, where this is the problem, you are getting left behind, and I'm the one to fix it. Those are exact words, right? I alone can fix it, which has this sort of authoritarian edge to it, which is also the playbook of the populist, is that we can't rely on the institutions and the systems. We need someone to break through these things because it's all being rigged against us. And even in the Republican Party, as Dr. Medved pointed out, right, there's a huge purge amongst sort of mainstream, which are now sort of labeled never Trump or Republicans.
Speaking of course, part of the irony here with to the extent that there's an anti-government part to this, and I don't think it's, you know, I think there is an anti-government, again, rhetoric and kind of symbolic ideological point to make there. But I think in policy grounds, there's not as much I don't think the rural areas are as anti-government as you might expect. But the irony is, of course, that as jobs leave rural areas, increasingly the workforce is made up of government workers, people who work for county, local and county governments, right? So it's a complex stew. You can't just say that this is a very purely conservative, small government, anti-government movement, because a lot of the people in rural areas that are voting against the party that we think of as the party of government benefit tremendously from government.
Yeah, we often think rural is agricultural, and it is, but the biggest sectors in it are really education, healthcare, social services, or social welfare, not social welfare, but social services. And those are really the biggest and the biggest expanding area. And down near Shippensburg, Chambersburg, for instance, clearly is driven by those pieces. Even if, as you drive through the fields of dairy farms and soybeans and corn and whatnot, along with it.
Here's a question from a listener, Jerry, along the lines of technology. And Dr. Beale, I'll point this one to you. Are we really more divided, or is our ability to communicate more through social media magnifying the differences? Also, when I was young, news was 30 minutes. He's talking about network news. I challenged my friends to only watch news for 30 minutes and see how bad it seems then. So social media is one of the things that's been brought into this equation in the past 15 years or so that has really helped to divide the different tribes, the different factions of people, Dr. Bailey.
Yeah, I when I'm sitting around with fellow political scientists, I always say, I think what we need to do is allow news to only be broadcast for a certain, you know, every station gets 3 hours of news, and that might solve a lot of our problems. Like a wave of magic wand. One, but actually it is an issue, and there's a lot to the media and how we understand its impact on us. I think it is part of our sort of this great sorting, at least ideological sorting. And part of this is a big shift towards a focus on national news and away from local and regional news. I hate to say that, given the radio station. The disinvestment, mainly because you can't make money at it, of local newspapers and local news. And so everybody pays attention to national stories, most of which don't affect their lives, but they animate our politics and the way we think about it.
Mm. And no, I agree. I was going to add right there that, you know, we have seen so many newspapers, local newspapers in this country that have folded over the last 10 years. Local school board meetings aren't getting any coverage. Well, they are now because of mask protest. But think about it. Before mask, when was the last time a school board meeting got the kind of coverage in a newspaper that it used to get on a regular basis? City council, town supervisors, all those things that no longer get covered because of local news. And I mean, we see it here. In that there are so many people interested in the national issues. So, you know, social media has had a great impact on this. We have another email from Jeremy, and I'm going to have to change some language here. Regarding what was stated in the show's intro, Drive around rural Franklin County, and not only do you see loads of Trump signs, but you also see loads of signs saying something Biden, and you for voting for him. And almost as many of those lovely signs out there as there are churches. So go figure. I was going to give a couple more examples. There have been several events just in the last week, a NASCAR race, for example, a college football game in the South, where crowds were chanting an expletive toward Joe Biden. Now, these were not political events. When did this become a thing that... I guess the point is that Joe Biden is a divisive figure in the eyes of Trump supporters, Dr. Medvick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's all of a piece, right? All of this. I mean, once polarization begins to take hold, it's really hard to reverse it. And one of the things driving it is a 50-50 country. So you've got, you know, almost doesn't matter who the two nominees for the two parties will be for president. It's going to be a razor thin election. Now, maybe something shifts that and breaks that pattern. But as long as it's a 50-50 country, the Senate is held 50-50. The House is razor thin. That makes politics, you know, a blood sport. And so it feeds, and then the social media feeds it as well. And so everything in this environment becomes politicized. And as Dr. Bailey said before, political party becomes the kind of umbrella identity for all of us, so that everything else, the sports we watch, the teams maybe we root for, the shows we watch on television, all of it, our religion, all of it falls underneath the political party banner. And so everything is literally politicized.
Hey, Dr. Bailey, this is not the listener mentioned Franklin County, but this is not just something in a rural county like Franklin County. I've seen it in almost every county in our listening area where language that would not be used in public is almost common now toward one candidate or the other.
Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback off of what Dr. Medvick said, it is this team sport, this piece where, you know, it's not even literally about Joe Biden. It's about the party split. But it's fascinating because parties, in terms of their interaction in our life, are very weak. And I bet not a single listener or very few listeners have ever like gone to a true party function. Like they might donate to a candidate or go to a candidate function, but not a party function. But in terms of how you vote, it's very strong indicator, and that's been around forever. Now in terms of it being part of your lifestyle, right? Just as much as you root for, you know, the Yankees or the Red Sox, I guess just say the Phillies or the Buccaneers, but we tend to attach it to ourselves that way, so it gets ramped up. We saw this under Trump as well. From my just casual observations, I didn't quite see the expletives used. But, you know, President Trump, I think, threw out a pitch at National Stadium, if I'm remembering right, and he was, you know, resoundingly chanted and booed. And so we saw other events like that. But it does seem to be amped up more. But part of that, I think, is the nature of Trump, who used expletives and liked to rile up his crowd. The nature of his type of populism is such that I don't care about your feelings, and an idea of politeness doesn't matter. There's bigger things at stake, maybe. Yeah. But this, the team sport thing is really, the word I use with my students is brutal. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. You just see friendships and families and churches and civic groups just almost crumble through this sort of shifting around and what you can handle. And then you pile in all these other issues that are beyond the parties, things like Black Lives Matter or other kinds of movements to try to affect change. And it just throws, you know, it just amps it all up even more.
Yeah. And if I could, you know, I don't think we can have this conversation without talking about the electoral system itself and the kind of party system that we have. I mean, a two-party system exacerbates this in lots and lots of ways. I said before that, you know, there is some agreement on policy between rural areas and suburban areas and suburban areas and urban areas. We see that, you know, in a system that has multi-party system, proportional representation that allows for multiple parties to win. We see voters in urban areas voting for right of center parties. They're economically more conservative, but socially liberal. We see some voters in rural areas voting for more left wing parties that are liberal or left wing economically, but maybe more conservative socially. There's a really interesting example in Austria. So Austria, for their parliament, has proportional representation. They have multiple parties. And what you see happening there is you don't have the clear urban-rural divide in terms of partisanship. You have, again, as some people in Vienna voting for what we might think of as right-wing parties, or at least right-of-center party. But in their presidential election, where they only elect one person and they have two rounds of voting so that they can guarantee there's a majority winner, in their most recent presidential election, when you got to that second stage, when there are only two parties, you had a Green Party candidate and you had a far-right party candidate. And guess what? What you saw was urban-rural divide. Hmm. So you had even those somewhat conservative urban voters saying, I can't vote for the far-right candidate, I'll vote for the Green. And those people in the rural areas who might vote for a left-wing economic party saying, no way, I'm voting for the far-right party. So I think part of what's happening here is we're locked in. You have two choices. It's either Republican or Democrat. And that system helps to exacerbate the polarization.
So that's
the primary system alone, right? It's going to select, you know, if we go off, you know, basic political science, you're going to run to the sides on the primary and go to the center for the general. And what we're seeing is you go to the sides for the primary. And at least in the case of Trump, his strategy was very unique and probably would not have, he probably couldn't find a political consultant that would tell him to do it. But his was to run to the right and keep running to the right, even in the general election. That can amp up it as well.
Let's take a phone call from Vince in Lebanon. Vince, you're on Smart Talk.
Well, good morning, Scott. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Just great, great. And I would just like to comment, just hearing some of the things that you're speaking of today. It seems like the rural area has some type of mentality that they're searching for something new, searching for something different, and not necessarily looking at the facts, not necessarily looking at the political structure even. And frankly, I just don't understand what they saw in our last president. He surely lied a lot. He continues to lie a lot. And just a point I'm talking about the difference between Democratic and Republican structures that trying to improve things in this country. Our last president had 4 years to try and improve our infrastructure, which is trying to happen right now under the Biden administration. And he also had 4 years to run broadband, which the comments are, yeah, we should have done that a long time ago. 4 years ago, he had the ability to do that. And I thank you for your time.
All right. Vince, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Bailey, you know, this goes back to one of the earlier questions that I had about some of the things that the rural areas or rural voters were looking for. Really, they didn't get, as Vince pointed out, didn't get broadband. Infrastructure is something that both parties can agree on, although right now it's not exactly Democrat versus Republican, although there is some aspect of that. But the point that he's making, that 4 years of Donald Trump, you know, it was often said that the rural voters voted against their best interest. Did they?
Well, it depends on what interest you're looking at. I mean, it is strange that rural populist voters would elect a multimillionaire New Yorker. Right. Who a non-religious multimillionaire New Yorker to add to it. It seems like a strange piece to it. And there's always been this curious thing that observers and politicians sort of observe that there is this sort of split between economic and social interests. So Ronald Reagan gets elected. We see the complete final collapse of whatever was left of the New Deal coalition, and the rise of the Republican Party starts in the South. And he gets elected by a lot of blue collar unionized workers. And Ronald Reagan rises to be one of the greatest union busting presidents we've ever had. And so you would say economically, it makes no sense but he gets elected basically on a sort of family values, anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage and gay rights, a school uniform, school prayer, kinds of these, you know, social conservative causes that go with it. And so we see it a lot. So we see it actually in the Democrats. I always find it funny that we look at rural voters and say, oh, they're so silly for not voting their economic interest. But there's lots of wealthy Democrats that don't vote their economic interest, mm-hmm. right? They vote for an increase in taxes and increase in regulation, maybe of their own businesses along the way. And of course, the answer to that is, well, they have the money to be able to do that. It's not going to hurt their economic interest per se. Mm-hmm. But there is this kind of weird connection. And part of what Trump, I think, represented was just trying to blow it all up. That is, I'm tired of being lectured by urban elites. And, you know, it's almost like a legacy. I often trace it back to the progressive era, where you get the rise of experts and social sciences that have the one right answer. And if you just listen to them, you even see this with the vaccine, right? I don't want to listen to Fauci. I don't want to listen to more epidemiologists. I don't even know what an epidemiologist is. I'm tired of being told what to do, and that the smart, educated college people are that. And for some reason, we don't have value here in the rural. And I think Trump somehow tapped into that, even if it doesn't make sense on paper.
And I think, you know, the caller said that the rural voter attitude seems to be to looking for something new. And I think the caller's right in terms of looking for some kind of candidate, a politician that breaks the mold. But in broader terms, what they're actually looking for is a return to a previous era. You know, they really don't like changes that they're seeing of all sorts, economic, but also cultural and social. And so what they're really hoping for is to go back in time. And Trump promised that, you know, we'll bring back the steel mills, which is a virtual impossibility. But, you know, this is the promise and this is the claim. It'll be the America you remember, even if the America they remember isn't exactly how they think of it. If it's not quite, that may not be quite an accurate memory, but still there's in the head, in the minds of a lot of rural voters, there's a longing for something previous. And that's part of the resentment that they feel to the changes that they're seeing.
Dr. Medvick. Yeah, there's almost like growing pains is not right, but the shifts demographically and economically are painful. And so what I think rural areas are experiences is that pain. We've seen it for a long time. I mean, the steel mills have been closing for a long period of time. And so I think part of it is also just how to cope with that culturally and socially. And we haven't talked much about it, but a big part of that is race, because one of the big shifts is race. And of course, race is almost always tied into populism. And there's just a basic disagreement in America about the role of race and the importance of race between the left and the right, and between rural and urban voters.
Right. And it's part of the breakdown of the New Deal coalition, right? As I mentioned, it starts as early as 1948. It is very fundamentally about race. So, you know, Scott's earlier question about, you know, is this, how much of this is economics? It is partially economics, but you can't disentangle the attitudes about race and a perception of what the changes in the economy have been.
Well, then along those lines, we are experiencing, and the 2020 census has shown this, has borne this out, is that America's demographics are changing. It's estimated that whites will be in the minority in this country nationwide by 2050, maybe even sooner now. Some states that's already happened, like California, for example. So what does that mean going forward? I hate to say for the two political parties, but for those who are Trump voters, those who are Biden voters, what does this changing demographics mean?
Yeah, well, add to that that urbanization will continue as well. The projections are that by 2050, will be 90% urbanized. Right now, we're at around 80% urbanized. Most people live in cities. And so that trend will continue as well. And you would think on the face of it that would mean sort of the death knell for the Republican Party, unless it changed and tried to make appeals to different kinds of voters. But in a polarized era, you can hold on to lots of voters almost regardless of what the platform is. And keep in mind that President Trump did slightly better in 2020 with a lot of minority voters than he had in 2016, which is, you know, to some people kind of shocking, because they look at it and they say, you know, given those 4 years and all that occurred, how could that be? I think it's because like everyone, there are liberal and conservative and moderate voters in all racial and ethnic groups. And I think he made an appeal, a kind of law and order appeal, to many Hispanic voters and even some African-American voters. So, you know, it's you would think that the strategy would be to try to make the Republican Party a bigger tent. But I'm not sure they have to do that to remain competitive. I mean, we'll have to see.
Let's take a phone call from Jim in Middletown. Jim, you're on Smart Talk.
Yeah, I have a million questions.
Well, we only have about 7 minutes left, Jim.
Okay, well, I'll make it two questions. Which political party practices cancel culture and why? And if you look at the history of the Democratic Party, they are more systemically racist than anybody else. For instance, which president should the KKK move in the White House? Woodrow Wilson, a progressive Democrat? The Democrats during the Civil War in the South were against giving slaves the right, the blacks the right to vote, and also wanted blacks to be slaves. Which political party was Martin Luther King a part of? He was a Republican because Democrats hate him. They called him a communist and tried to wiretap him.
All right, Jim, I think we get your gist. Dr. Bailey, cancel culture, I think he's pinning that on Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there's sort of two parts to this. And the label cancel culture certainly has gotten sort of tagged to Democrats. And clearly the fights within the Democratic Party might label this broader idea of cancel culture. But I think both parties engage in it in different ways. They find other ways to signal it. The term snowflake, for instance, is a cancel culture type piece to it. I have one of my favorite students in my class has a coffee mug that is on it, says liberal tears. And he likes to sit in the front row and drink from his coffee cup. So these are all, I think we see in both of these, although I think it has been attached to the Democratic Party, to the more liberal side of it. The party argument really, the problem with it, of course, is the Democrats all become Republicans. So what you're referring to are, and the reason why they become Republicans is because the Democratic Party takes race seriously in the 1960s around the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And so what we get is a massive shift of all those Democrats into the Republican Party based on this Southern strategy adopted by Nixon in the 70s. And embraced all the way along the way. We have plenty of examples of it. And so no party can really trace themselves back very far without it really pretty much collapsing as a way to connect to it.
So you have
Robinson, as Scott pointed out earlier, Republican, Martin Luther King for a time there as well. I actually had dinner with Jackie's widow once.
Oh, yeah.
Like, look, yeah. Party of Lincoln, you know, in their household, she said they had a picture of Lincoln on their wall. But this all shifts. This is to make those connections doesn't really work. But I get Jim's idea is that, look, we have plenty of blame to go around. The idea that Democrats go around being righteous and they have some long history of civil rights is a misnomer.
Let's take a phone call from Tony in Lancaster. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi. I haven't listened to the whole show, to this whole show, but it seems that this discussion is taking place out without putting it in the context of something that's unprecedented, which is that our election was, there was a serious attempt to throw out the votes of many voters. And people on the right are being told that the election was stolen. And people on the left are being told through evidence, of court cases and all sorts of stuff, that was not true and it wasn't true. But to have this discussion outside of that context doesn't really make sense.
Hey, Tony, thank you. We only have a few minutes, so I'm going to have Dr. Medvick address what you're saying. And this goes back to the divide. I mean, that may be one of, and that's not a rural and urban divide, but that's one that perpetrated by former President Trump.
Oh, right. I mean, it is part of the broader polarization, part of the broader divide. I mean, the program is about the urban-rural divide, so our focus has been mostly on that, and trying to explain why there are differences. But what the caller is really getting at is, what are the consequences of those divisions? And the consequences are that people are now in sort of, for the most part, in kind of cocoons. They live near people who think like them. They vote with people who agree with them. And in this case, I think we just have to be objective. We have to be objective and say that the overwhelming evidence is that the election was not stolen. But people are in their silos, and so they're not really getting information from the other side, and that's potentially dangerous. And again, you know, in this case, you could say one side really is accurate and one side isn't. Maybe that's true with vaccines as well. But what it really points to is people just being in completely different universes in terms of how they understand the way the world works.
We only have about 2 minutes left. And Dr. Medvick, I'm going to put this to you because you've just written a book about the redistricting. We talked to you on the air about that. The votes for Biden were concentrated in urban areas and increasingly in suburbs of larger cities. But concentration is the key word. For redistricting purposes, Biden or Democratic voters can be concentrated in smaller areas geographically because there are more people living there, where Republican districts can be spread out to larger areas geographically. Bottom line, the rural districts may end up with more members of Congress and have an outsized influence, even if a Democrat got more voters overall. So, I mean, that just seems like that's going to be the way it is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even if Democrats were to control redistricting entirely, there's only so much they can do. They could sort of maybe balance the or level the playing field, but there is an inherent kind of geographical bias toward rural areas, particularly when we've had the kind of sorting that we've seen. So Democrats overwhelmingly win cities where most of the people live, and Republicans win comfortably in rural areas, but not by as large a margin. And so if you just add up votes statewide, you see that Democrats and Republicans have about the same number of votes, or in fact, maybe Democrats even have a few more. But given the way districts are drawn, you're going to have a kind of Republican bias in the map. And this is why I brought up earlier the electoral system. We really have to understand the way the structure of our system produces a lot of what we're seeing.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. I want to read an email from Deb. It says, I believe a large part of the challenge between rural and urban voters has to do with their personal knowledge and education. I find so many people do not read anything or seek out facts anymore. They lazily listen to social media or dial into TV that portrays the political situation in a reality TV mode. They treat the former president as though he's a TV star and don't try to understand the reality of government and true freedom. We'll kind of leave it on that note. But Dr. Stephen Medvick, director of the Franklin Marshall College's Center for Politics and Public Affairs, and Dr. Lance Bailey, associate professor of political science at Shippensburg University. Fascinating conversation. I want to thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Great conversation.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.